President Putin has called up 300,000 more troops to go to the front lines. Many of those Russians don't want to fight, so they steer clear of the authorities.
I asked my wife not to open the doors to anyone. We are considering to move to apartment of her mother. We are worried.
Also today, the president of El Salvador wants to ignore constitutional term limits, one step further toward authoritarianism. Our guest says the U.S. is clueless.
If you ask me, the Biden administration has no idea what to do in Central America.
I'm Marco Werman, and royal memorabilia is flying off the shelves in London, but cash for monarch swag is brand dependent.
It's going to be difficult. I don't think we will sell as much for Charles.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Good to have you with us here on this Thursday. There's a lot at stake with the war in Ukraine, for the Ukrainian people, for Russia, but also for the entire globe.
The very international order that we have gathered here to uphold is being shredded before our eyes.
That's Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking today at the United Nations Security Council. Blinken told foreign ministers gathered in New York that investigators are learning more about atrocities in Ukraine, residential areas, hospitals, and dams hit by Russian shelling, accounts of torture by Russian troops. Blinken said Vladimir Putin will not be allowed to get away with it.
One man chose this war. One man can end it. Because if Russia stops fighting, the war ends. If Ukraine stops fighting, Ukraine ends.
Later, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, addressed the Security Council. He echoed Kremlin talking points about why this war is happening. Here is Lavrov speaking through an interpreter.
We have no doubt that Ukraine has become a completely totalitarian, Nazi-like state where the norms of international humanitarian law are trampled on.
Lavrov laid blame at the feet of Ukrainian leaders and the West, and he accused nations supporting the government in Ukraine of being on the wrong side of history. What he did not mention were the protests in Russia, sparked by Putin's announcement to recruit 300,000 more troops for the war in Ukraine. The World's Daniel Hoffman is following all of this. What do we know about these protests in Russia, Daniel?
Reactions across Russia varied, but one visible reaction, as you noted, were protests in some cities across Russia, including Moscow, Ekaterinburg, and St. Petersburg. This is from a video posted online on social media, and what they're chanting there is Putin to the trenches, and that's in Putin's hometown of St. Petersburg. Others chanted no to war and other stuff like that. We haven't seen protests like this since the war started, but to be clear, as far as we can tell, these weren't mass protests. It's difficult to estimate the numbers, but it was in the thousands, likely not in the tens of thousands. Russian authorities, though, did crack down harshly, even though the protests were limited. According to a Russian human rights organization called OVD Info, more than 1,300 people were detained across Russia for protesting last night.
So we've also seen reports that many people are now trying to leave Russia. What have we learned about that?
That's right, Marco. There seems to be another wave of departures from Russia, reminiscent of scenes that we saw back in February and March at the beginning of the war. Back then, people were leaving for a variety of reasons, like not wanting to be in Russia as it unleashes a war in Ukraine. Sanctions made people want to leave, fears of being stuck in Russia, a lack of stability, and overall feeling there's no future for them in Russia. Now, 7 months later, some are leaving for the same reasons, but many are leaving because of Putin's mobilization announcement. Until now, a large portion of the population in Russia didn't directly feel the impact of the war. Now, fears of getting drafted and being forced to fight in Ukraine has become a red line for many and has led to this exodus. It's difficult to get a sense of the scale here, but one clear indicator is that flight tickets to get out of Russia are all booked up, prices are spiking, and we're also seeing reports of some long lines at various land borders between Russia and other countries. So this is a significant shift.
So people trying to get out of the country, how else are people responding to this news that 300,000 reservists will be mobilized to fight in Ukraine?
Again, it really varies. Let's remember that leading up to the war, but certainly since the war started, Russian authorities crack down on dissenting voices in Russia. Many are in prisons, others have left the country. One of the results of that is that it's harder to get information about people's real opinions. But that being said, there is a significant portion of the population that believes in the government line. They support Putin, they watch state TV, and they're not necessarily resisting mobilization. A large segment of the population is apolitical. Some are passive, but some are against the mobilization. In other words, they're not protesting, but they don't want to go to war, and they certainly don't want to send their kids to the military. And then there are politically active people who are against the war. People like Stanislav Yudin. He's a military historian in his mid-30s living in Moscow. I talked with him on the phone earlier today.
I myself really worried because no one knows what are the destiny. Are they going to be mobilized? No one knows. The best strategy for me is to avoid any contact with authorities.
Yudin said that although the government's official mobilization plan is to draft an additional 300,000 people to join the war effort, many people in Russia believe that that number can expand. That's why he's avoiding contact with authorities.
I asked my wife not to open the doors to anyone. We are considering to move to apartment of her mother. We are just thinking right now what to do because, yes, we are worried, 100% worried.
Wow, he sounds kind of desperate. Daniel, we also saw reports yesterday of a major prisoner swap between Russia and Ukraine. What do we know about that?
This is a big deal, Marco, and here's what we know. Russia released 215 Ukrainian prisoners. Some of them are senior commanders who were part of Ukraine's defense of the southern port city of Mariupol and were even among the troops stranded at the Azovstal steel plant, making a last stand against Russian occupation. These troops have become heroes in Ukraine, symbols of the country's resistance. And in Ukraine, their return is a victory for President Volodymyr Zelensky's administration. On the other end of the deal, though, Ukraine has released 56 Russian prisoners, including the oligarch Viktor Medvedchuk. Medvedchuk was an oligarch based in Ukraine, but he was very pro-Russian with close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Also, some of the people released in the swap were not just Russians and Ukrainians. There are reports that two Americans and five citizens of the UK were among those released. This was a complex deal, and reportedly Turkey and Saudi Arabia played a role in brokering it. What's perhaps hopeful here is we're seeing that despite the harsh fighting on the battlefield, Russia and Ukraine are still negotiating, at least when it comes to the exchange of prisoners. And for many, that is an encouraging sign.
The World's Daniel Hoffman bringing us some of the reaction in Russia to the news that Vladimir Putin is calling up 300,000 reservists to fight an increasingly tough battle in Ukraine. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, has fewer and fewer friends in the European Union these days. Last week, the EU Parliament said Hungary can no longer be considered a fully functioning democracy. That's because of the way Orban's government has throttled the news media and changed the country's electoral system. Something else that's a big concern to the EU, Hungary's treatment of its own ethnic minorities. Roma people are the largest ethnic minority there. They've lived in Hungary for centuries and have long faced discrimination. But one radio station in Budapest is now trying to change attitudes towards the Roma community. From Hungary, our Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
A mi rádiónk, a mi hangunk, a mi hangunk. Rádió Dík. Romákról, nem csak romáknak.
Radio Dík is Hungary's only Roma radio station, and Santi Munzari is one of its top female presenters. Munzari presents a show called Zsásé with her co-host Melanie Nagy.
It's about us, it's about two young Roma divorced. My colleague is divorced too, with two children. And we are trying to choose such topics that are interesting to everyone.
Munzari tells me that being a single mom makes her different from many women in the Roma community. I ask her how unusual divorce is among Roma women.
Extremely unusual because they tend to stay within bad relationships. Even there is the domestic abuse. They say that because of the children we should stay. Or how I'm going to keep up. I don't have 1,000 forint in my hand. And it's also about the shame because there is a friend of mine. She was divorced and her family didn't take her back.
And Munzari says there are lots of topics our community won't talk about.
When I get pregnant by my husband, we needed to act like it's from the Holy Spirit. You understand? This is topics you've never speak about. You never speak about that you've got your menstruation. Never. Never, ever.
And she wants a radio show to break some of these taboos. Radio Deek began broadcasting earlier this year. All the staff are Roma. They broadcast in Hungarian. Most Roma people speak Hungarian as their mother tongue. Some also speak a Romani language called Lovari. Sandy Manzari's father is from a long line of traditional Roma musicians, while her mother is non-Roma, which she says didn't go down so well with her father's family.
My grandmother was putting wet towels on her head, doing all this show, like she cannot accept it. She wanted my father to stay inside the Roma community, to marry a gypsy girl who can cook, who can bear children. Everybody's like, oh my God, she's not gypsy, what's going to happen?
Manzari says everyone gets along just fine nowadays. Going to school over 20 years ago, she remembers being singled out for being Roma. But segregation of Roma children in Hungary continues even today. Just 2 years ago, the country's Supreme Court ordered a school to pay compensation to Roma families for what it called unlawful segregation and substandard education. Prime Minister Viktor Orban said the school should refuse to pay up. Bernard Rourke is with the European Roma Rights Centre in Budapest.
Viktor Orban was furious and he portrayed the parents as feckless, the children as unruly and uneducatable, and said that he's on the side of 80% of honest Hungarians. What we will not do is give money to people for nothing.
Rourke has been working on Roma rights issues for more than two decades in Hungary. But he says since Orban came back to power in 2010, things have gotten steadily worse for the Roma community.
The European Commission more than 5 years ago initiated infringement proceedings against Hungary for school segregation. And in recent reports noted that segregation has actually worsened in Hungary.
But not everyone sees it this way. István Forgás is Roma and a regular commentator on Hungarian television. Forgás tells me some schools appear to have only Roma children, not because of segregation.
It is because the non-Roma families have less babies than a couple of decades ago. The Roma families have more than a couple of decades ago. It means that in the schooling system, we can see that the high number of Roma kids is mostly because of this difference.
During the height of the migrant crisis in Europe in 2015, Hungary only accepted a tiny number of refugees. Many were fleeing from countries like Syria and Afghanistan. Viktor Orban's justice minister said at the time, Hungary was not in a position to take in any migrants because the government's hands were full dealing with its own Roma population. I asked Forgás how those comments made him feel.
He didn't use the word problem. He said that we have our own challenge to do something with our Roma, so we don't have capacity, money and will to do anything with the migrants. And for me personally, I had no any problem with it.
Back in the radio station, Sandy Manzari gives me a tour of the studios.
This is the morning show.
The presenters are playing music by Roma musicians Dorina and Kishpera. Manzari says all the music on the station is by Roma artists, but she says her listeners come from all parts of Hungarian society. I ask her if she ever receives any abuse from listeners just for being Roma.
From non-Roma, we don't get any bad things. But the non-Roma people are fascinated by you. They want to get to know you. They are interested in your views, your studies, your experiences. They respect you a whole lot.
In fact, Manzari says the only abuse she gets is from the Roma community itself for being so outspoken. But it doesn't bother her. That means I must be doing the job right, she says. For the world, I'm Orla Barry in Budapest.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Across the globe, many countries are saddled with too much debt right now, from Sri Lanka to Egypt, from Pakistan to Ethiopia. When nations owe too much money to their lenders, it can be hard for governments to perform basic functions. Just look at Sri Lanka, where gas, even food, is in short supply. As a result, protesters essentially threw out a president and a prime minister there. Here to explain how all these debt problems are happening is Vasuki Shastri. He's an associate fellow at the Asia-Pacific program at Chatham House in Washington. Vasuki, why are so many countries dealing with such crippling debt right now? And roughly how many countries are we talking about?
The range of countries, according to the IMF, who are either facing debt distress today, and Sri Lanka certainly fits into that category, and so are many countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And then you've got many countries in the waiting room who are not yet facing debt distress, but because of the worsening macroeconomic conditions in the world, may well coming or knocking on the IMF's door over the next 12 months.
So let's break down the various causes behind all this debt at various countries, starting with how much global inflation and the attempts to drive it down by raising interest rates. How has that affected the debt crisis?
We have the pandemic, which was another great accelerator in fiscal and monetary expansion by developed country central banks. So this created a wall of money. You know, you had this hyper-concessional, almost cheap money, which became available for emerging markets and developing countries to finance their development. That party has ended. And a lot of these developing countries now are in the front line of distress because they are realizing that all the money that they raised through borrowing, servicing that debt has become much more expensive.
Generally, how is corruption impacting the cases of national debt across the world?
It's a huge issue because on one hand, we are insisting countries like China, who are lending huge sums of money, to be transparent about their loan conditions. So if you don't have transparency at the stage of the lender and you don't have transparency at the stage of the borrower, then you know there's a great deal of vulnerability. Then money is going to be misspent. It's going to be misdirected. And we've seen this in many, many countries where many infrastructure projects are launched with a great deal of fanfare. Then costs begin to rise, mainly because of corruption.
How does an institution like the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund approach a situation like this? Because you don't want a population to suffer. At the same time, you don't want to loan money to a government where there's just little accountability.
Yeah, you know, the IMF, I think, is an impossible situation, and Sri Lanka probably is a test case. I mean, the IMF is going ahead with providing that financial package, which Sri Lanka desperately needs. The IMF has made it very clear it wants financing assurances. Essentially, it wants assurances from Sri Lanka's creditors, including China, so that, you know, Sri Lanka now has this little bit of time and space to receive foreign assistance, to rebuild its economy, and probably in a year or two or 3 years' time, it will then be able to resume repaying its debts. If all creditors are able to take this view and provide a little bit of breathing space for Sri Lanka, then I think that forms the basis for not only helping restore Sri Lanka's economic stability, but I think it also forms the basis for dealing with developing country distress, debt distress.
Vasuki, do you see a positive light on the horizon? Like, where's the hope for countries in debt?
So there's positivity in terms of there's a greater number of players in this. So you've got the private sector certainly involved in many of these debt distress situations. They can be part of the solution. So the burden is not only on taxpayers of rich countries. But the thing that I would worry about most is global governance is kind of fraying, mainly because of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. I think that's a big concern because if we all agree that we're facing extraordinary economic crisis, then we need a global solution.
Vasuki Shastri is an associate fellow of the Asia-Pacific program at Chatham House. He joined us from Washington. Vasuki, thank you very much. Good to speak with you again.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Forever in our hearts. That is the slogan printed on thousands of commemorative t-shirts being sold across London to honor the late Queen Elizabeth II. Souvenir shops have been struggling to keep up with the demand for royal swag. Reporter Rebecca Rossman went on a tour of London to see what's selling.
Purple velvet curtains drape the window fronts at the official royal gift shop located just a stone's throw from Buckingham Palace. The shop has remained closed since Queen Elizabeth II's death earlier this month. But next door at Majestic Gifts, business is booming.
It's been really, really busy these days since, like, couple of weeks.
Manager Nasir Abdul says he rushed to get hundreds of commemorative T-shirts and 20-pound mugs emblemed with the Queen's face and her years of service.
This is Queen Elizabeth II, the greatest reign, 1952 to 2022.
I was just looking at anything that's here, really, and seeing what was new.
Suzanne Kemp shows me some magnets she just purchased commemorating the Queen's Platinum Jubilee in June. Merchandise from the Platinum Jubilee generated more than $326 million in sales over the summer alone, according to the UK Centre for Retail Research. The majority of what's being sold right now is Jubilee leftovers.
Obviously, because of the timing, they hadn't had time to prepare anything else, so everything for the Jubilee's kind of been selling out.
Sham Sangani runs Love London Souvenirs in Russell Square.
So on this table here, we do have figurines of the Queen waving, a lot of Queen mugs, pens. This is actually a box of tea for the Queen's Platinum Jubilee.
Sangani says anything with the Queen's face on it has been a hit for his family-run shop, which recently celebrated 37 years in business. Indeed, a 2021 poll found the Queen's brand allure was greater than Nike, Ferrari, and Pepsi. I asked Sangani what he thinks about the potential for merchandise with the King.
It's hard to say. Up to now, for the past like 70 years, it's always been the Queen who's been there. It's going to be difficult. I don't think we will sell as much for Charles.
This is my museum, and inside here is about 7,000 items.
That's Anita Atkinson, who has perhaps the largest personal collection of royal memorabilia in the world. Over Zoom, she gives me a small tour of a museum she set up next to her house in Durham. The room is filled with tea towels, calendars, oil paintings, hundreds of china plates. But one of her favorite items is a framed napkin used by King Charles in 1977. She thinks the new king's selling potential is just as great as his late mother's.
This is a bottle of beer from 1969 to commemorate the investiture of the Prince of Wales.
I ask if she's thought about how the value of the collection, currently worth around $225,000, could change in the coming years. But she says she couldn't care less about money.
I'm not bothered whether this collection is valuable, because to me it's valueless. I'm never going to sell it. I'm never going to sell a single piece. So it doesn't matter whether it's worth a penny or £1 million. I don't care.
Atkinson's plans to eventually pass the collection down to her grandchildren, who she hopes will inherit the royalist fervor she's been building up for decades. But for people who do place a monetary value on these items, experts say hold on to them. They'll be worth more and more in the coming years. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, London.
It's The World. Experts know what makes Italian food so amazing: simplicity and a reliance on fresh ingredients.
The quality of Italian cuisine is to create with 3-4 products a dish.
But what happens to that dish when the locally grown produce is threatened by climate change? That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. This week in New York, it's all about world leaders speechifying from the UN General Assembly podium. Today's speakers included the presidents of Yemen, Somalia, and Spain. Earlier this week, the remarks from El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, raised some eyebrows.
Les traigo un saludo de la tierra de los volcanes, del surf, del café, del Bitcoin y de la libertad.
On Tuesday, Bukele described El Salvador as a land of volcanoes, surf, coffee, Bitcoin, and liberty. It's that last word that his critics at home are taking issue with. They say Bukele is becoming more authoritarian each day. They note that the Salvadoran leader recently announced he would seek re-election despite a constitutional ban. And he suspended some constitutional rights under an ongoing 6-month state of exception. For more on this, we've reached out to Carlos Dada. He's the co-founder and director of the Salvadoran digital news outlet, El Faro. So El Salvador's constitution, Carlos, includes a prohibition against presidents running for consecutive terms. Bukele's current term ends in 2024. So how is he able to run again?
His Congress dismissed the Supreme Court judges and put instead unconstitutionally judges that were sympathetic to the Bukele project or movement. The judges ruled that the constitution should be reinterpreted, allowing re-election, which was confirmed by the electoral tribunal, also controlled by Bukele. That's how we got here.
So basically, he loaded the courts in El Salvador in his favor, and that means he can do this end run around the constitution.
Exactly, but he did it without complying with the process previewed in the Salvadoran law.
So Bukele told the UN General Assembly this week that wealthy countries cannot give orders, those are his words, to those less well off. What sort of pressure is his government facing from the US, from Western nations?
That is a good question. He said exactly that powerful countries will not allow El Salvador to grow safely and in peace. But, I mean, why wouldn't they? It is in the main interest of the United States that El Salvador becomes a functional country, so the United States won't see millions of migrants walking north. What really is the issue here is that the United States is conditioning any foreign aid to Central American governments based on advances in democracy and human rights, and Mr. Bukele has done exactly the contrary.
So what kind of leverage does the U.S. have in El Salvador right now?
If you ask me, the Biden administration has no idea what to do in Central America. If you remember, the Biden administration appointed Vice President Kamala Harris as special envoy to the region. She made a trip to Guatemala, which turned out to be a disaster because she basically went down to say, don't come. And that was not welcomed by anyone in Central America. And that's the last we heard from her. If you ask me, the Biden administration still has no idea of how to grow a new relationship with these Central American authoritarian and populist new governments.
Where have those efforts by Vice President Harris led to? Wasn't there money earmarked to help the economies of countries like El Salvador so that people would be less inclined to flee?
Yes, but of course, foreign aid was conditioned, again, on clear steps on the fight against corruption, on clear steps to consolidate democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. And Central American governments have gone exactly the other way.
And yet Bukele, just 41 years old, he's very popular by many measures in El Salvador. Some polls have him around 85% favorability among voters. How do you understand his popularity, Carlos?
Well, you have to take into account that El Salvador is a very poor country that has been most of its population subject to control of gangs for over many years. Salvadorans are a desperate population right now, and whoever gives them any hope that their situation will be better, they will go after that. Bukele, his speech to the United Nations was basically a speech to Salvadoran people. It was broadcast that same night on national television. He was addressing Salvadorans, not the international community.
I mean, he is known as being extremely media savvy. What about his crackdown on street gangs? How is that going?
Well, for the first 2 years and a half, he told Salvadorans that the homicide rates that had dramatically descended since he got in power, that was the consequence of a very effective security plan. It turned out that he had cut a deal with the gangs and he had liberated some of gang members in exchange for this lowering in the homicide rates. When that deal broke apart 6 months ago, Bukele dictated a rule of exception and ordered police and the army to capture anyone with a green light. So right now, in 6 months, he has put in prison more than 60,000 Salvadorans without any constitutional guarantees. There is no right to defense now in El Salvador. He says that all of them are related to gangs, but our investigations prove the contrary, that at least 25% of those incarcerated, we're talking about thousands of people, have no relationship to gangs. Amnesty International says this is actually a criminalization of poverty because police just goes into poor communities and just arrest anybody. They don't need an order from a judge. But he is making everybody believe that he's cracking down on gangs.
Carlos, where is all this taking El Salvador?
Bukele is just one step from becoming a dictator. He has turned the police and the army into his personal guards. He has taken by assault all the institutions and prosecuted all his opponents and critics. He controls the Attorney General's office, and he protects everybody under his wing and harasses and puts in prison any critic. He wants to silence all critic voices, and he is achieving it broadly. So the only step separating him from dictatorship is an unconstitutional election, which is going to happen in 2024.
Carlos Dada is the co-founder and director of the Salvadoran digital news outlet El Faro. He's been speaking about the increasingly authoritarian behavior by El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, who addressed the UN General Assembly this week. Carlos, really good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco. It's good to talk to you.
It's hard to separate the identity of Italy from food, whether it's Amalfi lemons that zest up gelato or the San Marzano tomatoes that bring pasta to life. But after decades of rising temperatures, the foods that define Italian flavors are becoming harder than ever to grow. From Padua, Italy, John Last reports.
Walk into many Italian restaurants, like this one in the center of Padua, and you'll likely notice something distinctive about the menu.
Yeah, local pork. Local veal, seasonal vegetables.
Italians love to eat local. Many menus feature foods and wines that come from the surrounding region and are crafted with care according to local tradition.
There's always been a great pride in the food of one's area.
Fabio Parasecoli is a professor of food studies at New York University and the author of Gastronativism, a book about food and identity. Parasecoli says because of Italy's incredible biodiversity, Italians have come to take local ingredients and traditional preparations very seriously. It's one reason why Italy's food exports are worth more than $60 billion.
They realize how important it is to maintain, let's say, the purity, the authenticity of the product.
But those authentic, local, and traditional products are becoming in many places harder and harder to produce. Italy's climate is changing, and fast. This year in the north, drought claimed nearly 60% of Italy's crop of risotto. Rising temperatures are affecting staples in the south as well.
Citrus fruit, like orange or lemons, with the increase of temperature, could disappear forever over time.
Andrea Moratino is a coffee roaster in Catania, Sicily. Where others saw a crisis in rising temperatures, Moratino spotted an opportunity. He knows Italians love coffee. There's an espresso bar on practically every corner here. But coffee is one of few Italian staples that has always been imported, until now. In their garden in Catania, Moratino's family has been nurturing coffee plants for 30 years, and increasingly, they're producing viable fruit.
Last year, we had 30 kilo harvest, and this year, we are going to have a 50 kilos harvest.
While 50 kilos may not be enough to fuel Italy's coffee addiction, it is proof that higher average temperatures are making locally grown coffee viable on a commercial scale in Sicily. Moratino is now sharing his methods with other farmers. He hopes Sicilian coffee could someday become like Sicilian wine, a prized export and a symbol of his native land.
If you look at food history, it would not be the first time that happens.
Parasecoli, the food historian, says what Moratino is doing is actually reflective of another long-standing Italian tradition, taking crops from abroad and developing them into local delicacies.
Think about what happened in the 16th century with the arrival of all the products from the Americas. Tomatoes, beans, pumpkins, zucchini, peppers, corn, stuff that now it's really considered part of the Italian identity. So if you look at it historically, it has happened, and probably it will happen again.
In fact, it already has. Ottavio Cacioppo is the man who first cultivated the kiwi fruit in Italy more than 40 years ago. Over time, Cacioppo helped create Italy's own distinctive variety of the fruit, the Latina kiwi, which earned designated status as a local delicacy in 2004. Cacioppo says rising temperatures mean new fruit are becoming viable across Italy. Fruit like bananas, mangoes, or avocados, which are already grown, like Moratino's coffee, at a small scale in some places. All of this raises the question, As Italy's local crops shift with climate change, will its local flavors? Will mango chutney someday become a Sicilian delicacy, alongside a cup of locally sourced coffee?
Hello, good evening.
To answer that question, I called Alex Ravelli Serini. He's a food philosopher at San Raffaele University in Rome. For Serini, Italy's culinary tradition is not found in its ingredients, but in its method.
I think the capacity, the quality of Italian cuisine is to create with 3-4 products a dish.
What makes Italian food Italian, he says, is its simplicity. Basing meals around local, fresh, high-quality ingredients prepared with care from farm to table, whatever they may be. That's certainly clear here at a restaurant table in Padua, where I'm about to dig into a pumpkin risotto, a seasonal staple here in the fall. As the climate changes, what I'm eating here may become entirely different. Maybe risotto will forever be off the menu. But one thing is for certain, Italians will still know how to eat. For the world, I'm John Last in Padua, Italy.
For more than 15 years, an international tribunal in Cambodia has been trying to bring the leaders of the Khmer Rouge to justice. Under that brutal regime in power in the late 1970s, an estimated 1.7 million Cambodians died. Today was the last day of the tribunal. In the end, it convicted just 3 people. Craig Etcherson is an expert on the Khmer Rouge and served as chief of investigations for the Office of the Prosecutors at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal from 2006 to 2012. Craig, bring us into the process of trying to convict someone for the genocide. I mean, how do you accommodate the range of legal, moral, and political interests at play?
It's a very difficult and time-consuming process. In the first instance, even though it was apparent to nearly everyone that the Khmer Rouge had violated very many international criminal laws, once you have an army and are in control of a nation, you find friends in strange places which you can retain even when you've been overthrown. So the political element of finding someone who is willing to enforce the law is the first and largest problem in any such process.
Was there something specifically about the Khmer Rouge and that regime's brutality that made this an especially arduous process?
Part of the problem was the longstanding alliance between the Khmer Rouge and the People's Republic of China. Another part of it was the reluctance of the United States to become involved, due in part to the United States' own brutal history in Cambodia. And part of it was simply the complexity of the scope and number of crimes that the Khmer Rouge committed during their 3 years, 8 months, and 20 days in power.
So were there players like China, the United States? Was the UN also kind of keeping their hands off of this?
For many years, the United Nations was very reluctant to get involved. In fact, the UN's special representative of the Secretary General for Human Rights in Cambodia at one point explicitly denied that genocide had occurred in Cambodia. So it took some doing to get everyone on the same page and agree to move forward with the process.
Had there been more international engagement with the Cambodian tribunal, would there be more convictions today?
I think not. The Cambodian government insisted on a measure of control over the process as a condition for allowing it to go forward at all. And in their deep concern that the 30 years' war, which had recently ended, not be rekindled again, they were very cautious about who they would allow to be prosecuted.
Does that account for part of the reason why the tribunal took place in Cambodia?
That was one small part of it. A larger part was that the people who focus on internationalized criminal tribunals had begun to realize that holding them in The Hague or somewhere far from the scene of the crime did not allow the people most concerned with such atrocities to be directly involved.
So did that in and of itself have an impact on Cambodians, regardless of how few people were convicted?
Very much so. Unlike other tribunals where the victims themselves were far from the process. In this case, approximately 250,000 Cambodians were actually able to attend a proceeding of the tribunal.
And what impact did that have?
To my mind, the most important impact of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal has been the extent to which it has supercharged national reconciliation in Cambodia. Prior to the tribunal, the very mention of the word Khmer Rouge was as if you had summoned a demon. There was almost a prohibition against talking about it. But the tribunal opened it up and allowed parents to talk to their children, schools to begin teaching about it, neighbor to talk to neighbor.
And would you say that national reconciliation was one of the dividends of having the tribunal in Cambodia?
Indeed, but it's a generational process, and that process is now well underway.
Using the Khmer Rouge Tribunal as a model, what would you take away from it to kind of ensure accountability in the future for crimes against humanity, and what would you recommend losing to avoid some of the pitfalls?
One of the inherent difficulties with the design of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal was the extent of control that was extended to the national government. That is, in one sense, deeply problematic from a purist point of view, and from another point of view, deeply appropriate from a pragmatic point of view. Establishing peace and security after a long and vicious war is no simple matter.
Craig Etchison served as chief of investigations for the Office of the Prosecutors at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal from 2006 to 2012. Craig, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Marco.
Something strange happened yesterday in the U.S. Senate, a bipartisan deal to join an international climate treaty. The Senate voted to join the Kigali Amendment. It was designed to phase out harmful chemicals in refrigerators and air conditioners. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
On the Senate floor, Foreign Relations Chair Bob Menendez painted a bleak picture of our planet. He spoke of wildfires in the east, flooding in the west, and hurricanes in the Caribbean. With all this, he said,
strong action to fight climate change has never been more urgent. In approving the Kigali Amendment, the Senate took the single most important climate action the Senate has taken in more than 30 years.
So what does this thing do? The Kigali Amendment requires countries to phase out chemicals in air conditioners and refrigerators called HFCs. The EPA estimates the treaty will reduce the projected rise in global temperatures by about 1 degree Fahrenheit by the end of this century. That might not sound like much, but in the fight against climate change, it's significant. This all began about a century ago. As hot and sticky as this sounds, our great-great-grandparents lived without the comforts of artificial cooling. But then in the 1920s and 30s, a new wonder chemical was invented that would later make air conditioners a daily luxury. Those chemicals were CFCs. Scientists didn't know it back then, but CFCs were slowly creating a hole in the ozone layer. So decades later, with more knowledge, the world came together, and in the 1980s, two dozen countries signed the Montreal Protocol to phase out CFCs. Former President George H.W. Bush spoke about it as a monumental achievement.
We've learned that worldwide united action is essential and possible, as the Montreal Protocol proved.
Countries replaced CFCs with HFCs, a safer alternative when it comes to the ozone layer. But turns out, HFCs bring problems too. They're a potent greenhouse gas. They trap a lot more heat than other greenhouse gases, like carbon dioxide. So now the world has agreed to phase out HFCs too. And that's what the Kigali Amendment does. In reality, the U.S. has already begun phasing them out. Congress and the Biden administration agreed to this last year. But Eric Dean Wilson, the author of After Cooling, says the symbolism of signing onto Kigali remains important.
The United States is the most mechanically cooled nation on the planet. We use more energy for cooling than just about any other country in the world. So for the United States to take the step and say that we're committed to no longer producing HFCs, that's major.
It's major for practical reasons, too. We learned a lesson from the Montreal Protocol. That agreement made it so that some countries could continue to produce CFCs while other nations phased them down. What happened was that a large black market emerged. CFCs became the most smuggled contraband after cocaine in the 1990s. We don't want the same thing happening with HFCs, says Wilson.
The Montreal Protocol taught us that these kinds of international agreements only work if every major party that produces the chemical is on board. You know, if one country like the United States, which is manufacturing this chemical, is able to continue producing it, it's going to make its way to other countries.
That's because chemicals don't respect international boundaries. So when it comes to phasing out harmful chemicals, what's good for one is good for all. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Just because fall has officially arrived does not mean you put ice cream on hold. I don't care how cold it is. It's not even a concern right now in the Southern Hemisphere. Temps are going up as spring begins there. In South Africa, a microbiologist is revolutionizing the ice cream business, dreaming up unique flavors with ingredients sourced from different parts of the continent. Those flavors are meant to evoke place and memories of the past, ancestors, people's childhoods, and cultural traditions. Tapiwa Guza is the microbiologist who is coming up with these flavors. He owns the Tapi Tapi ice cream shop in Cape Town. The World's Carol Hills caught up with Guza recently and asked him to describe a few of the flavors he's created.
So that's a little bit of an open-ended question, that one. We're currently around 900 flavors now. And we I can tell you what we have on the menu right now.
Yeah, tell me about a particular one you've created in recent weeks.
So on the menu at the moment, we've got a spice called Prekese from Ghana. You get a lot in Ghana, Nigeria, which is quite smoky and sweet smelling. And I've paired together with a jam from a fruit called a kai apple or umkokolo from South Africa. So it's going to be tangy, fruity, and a little bit smoky and sweet. Yeah, that's one example. So that's like West meets South. Yeah.
So is there a bestseller?
We don't really do repeat flavors, so there's no such thing as a bestseller, because we're more interested in showcasing and celebrating as much of the continent as possible, as opposed to trying to make as much money as possible.
Tapiwa, you're a molecular biologist. How did you get into making ice cream?
So part of the molecular biology world is using chemicals such as dry ice to keep things really cold and liquid nitrogen. And we used to have a steady supply of those resources in the departments. So one day I just decided to go make some ice cream after watching MasterChef and seeing them do it with dry ice and liquid nitrogen. And from that point, I realized it's quite a simple process, really. All you need is a way to churn and freeze ice cream nicely.
Hmm. Now, how do you get the ingredients you need for your ice cream? I mean, Africa is a big continent.
Ingredient sourcing is going to depend on a few different factors. So sometimes it's a matter of foraging, because you get a lot of the continental flavors here in South Africa. But sometimes it's also creating dishes that speak to a particular region. But the ingredients in that particular dish are often ubiquitous in the world, like flour, spices, sweet potatoes, pumpkins. Those are quite common ingredients all over the world. So sometimes you're trying to evoke the feeling of a dish as opposed to a particular ingredient. But also, we have a huge immigrant population in South Africa from across the continent, and anyone who comes from another place in the world will always bring their food from home with them.
Do you often get suggestions from customers or people who read about you? Oh, use these ingredients. This would remind me of my home.
Not only suggestions, people bring me the ingredients themselves, which is fantastic. It's a very nice way of working with the community and getting to really understand the ingredients and what the significance is for those people. And I encourage it more often than not. And I would say maybe 30 to 40% of our recipes are inspired by someone walking in and having a suggestion or having an actual product with them to try to turn into ice cream.
That was South African microbiologist Tapiwa Guza, who is creating unique ice cream flavors in Cape Town. He was chatting with my colleague, Carol Hills. Two scoops to go, and we are out of here. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong, my friends. Thank you for listening.
From PRX.